Welcome to the Times Podcast.
Boom, boom, bam. Welcome to the Times Podcast. Tap, tap, tap. That's the beat of my life. The Green Gart side of Scritti Politti. We are in a central London pub.
A weak heart drop. Oh, Papa, don't stop. Bittersweet about life.
We're talking about his Mercury-nominated new album, White Bread and Black Beer,
I do that all the time, actually. It's fantastic.
Which comes with dinky little metal badges depicting the aforementioned beer and bread. So, Green.
Yeah.
Tell me about being nominated for the Mercury Award after being away so long. What does that mean to you?
I don't know. It makes me deeply joyful, as you might have guessed. And what does it do? I remember somebody asking, I was in New York when they rang up and said, you've been nominated. And it was 4 o'clock in the morning, New York time, and I was not best chuffed. But you said, come on, Green, you've got to think of something to say about what it means to you. And I think what it did, it made me decide that after 20-something years of fannying about and whatever, that the job of pop musician might be the right one for me after all.
Okay.
That's what it means.
There's been long gaps between all your records, well, very long gaps recently. I mean, was
yes.
there ever a point where you were actually thought about giving up the whole thing?
I never had to. I didn't have to get a day job ever, because I was lucky enough, incredibly lucky enough in the 80s to make enough money not to have to get a real job. And as long as I never had to get a real job, then I could sort of, half of me could think I was still, you know, a musician, even if the other half didn't want to have anything to do with the business of making music. But I've always thought that I was a musician. Even when I hated the industry, I still loved the music.
And the new album is, you've sort of gone back to a very more traditional pop styling than previous records. Obviously, you reference hip hop and things like that.
Yeah,
but it's quite a trad songwriting type album.
It's all about the voice and the words, for better or worse. This one, and whereas previous ones have been concerned about grooves and technology and musicianship, things like that. Even this one has just been about paying. You know, I'm not really trying to impress anyone with my playing, because I'm not that great a player. The arrangements are all pretty simple to give some space for the words and the voice, and that's what it is.
I can't find a stand to take, to or from the road to ruin. Sure, I've got the sense to make a record of my own. I'm doing. I should like to mention a friend or some relation. I can't throw my father, but you can trust me, son.
Do you make a conscious decision with each album that it's going to sound in a particular way, or is that just what comes out during that period?
In this album, it was just what came out in the allotted span. And the brief was just to, you know, sit at home, write some songs, put them together, see what you get. And it's kind of surprised me how it turned out. It's a more personal and more, don't know. I'm amazed I actually managed to do it, you know, make a record on my own, something I never thought I could do or would do.
Does that explain why some of the songs certainly seem to be very personal, which is something you've resisted for 20-odd years?
Yeah.
How come you're now writing what sound like fairly straight love songs, which is something you would have distrusted in your Marxist theory days?
Well, I hope they're not straight love songs.
Sorry.
Gay love songs? Nah, they're still full of bits of twists of this and that. There is a bit more autobiographical stuff in it, but I've never liked, you know, the whole confessional singer-songwriter thing has never really appealed. So mixed in there with stuff about my old English teacher and various people I grew up with is, you know, your usual dollop of Schopenhauer. Actually, I've never read Schopenhauer, so I don't know if there's a dollop of him in there or not, but you know what I mean.
Please keep your love away. Keep your hands where I can see. There's nobody here you can trust. Oh,
worked with Kylie a couple of years ago, didn't you?
Yeah, that was an honour.
How did that come about?
She asked me to. I'm being flippant, you know, it was a surprise to me. All these things are a surprise to me. Singing with Elvis Costello, I got asked to do that. I didn't ever think it would happen. Miles Davis, never thought, covered by Madness. Singing with Kylie, work with whoever. You just can't plan for that kind of thing. So it was an honour.
Who was a more troublesome person to deal with, Kylie or Miles Davis?
Shabba Ranks, I think, would have all the people I've worked with. I'd have to put him at in pole position, shall we say.
Is your love-hate relationship with pop music anything to do with the fact that at some stage you realised pop was simply too shallow a medium for your massive critical and theoretical approach to it?
No, it's infinitely deeper and wider than any amount of intellect that anybody can throw at it, I reckon.
Okay.
Honestly. I mean, you don't believe me, but I kind of do.
No, I mean, I'm being half serious when I ask this question.
Yeah.
You have been called pretentious and intellectual in the past.
Happy to admit to both.
Those are insults in England, aren't they?
Not to me. I can think of much worse insults. Yeah. You know, unpretentious and pig ignorant. There's two. Monkey and a woman in an angry shade. Rocking in the kitchen till the break of the day. Monkey and a woman in a uniform. Rocking in the kitchen till the break of the dawn.
What's your relationship like with Wales? Are you fond of Wales?
Very fond of Wales. Get more and more fond of it, you know, all the time. Was very happy to leave it when I was a teenager. And for a long time didn't really relish the prospect of going back, but now I realise that my best mates are there. It's a beautiful place, and it would be awfully nice to, you know, end up there one day in the crematorium on the in the Esk Valley.
Yeah, which is where you lived for your
period. It's very nice.
Right. I mean, at that point, were you thinking that you were out of the music business completely? Because you had a studio there, didn't you?
Yeah, I did always have my gear there, but for quite a long while, I didn't want to use any of that equipment, and I felt quite phobic about music or anything to do with music. Didn't want to touch the, you know, kept them all locked behind the door in my room, the guitars and the keyboards and everything. But I finally overcame that when I decided that I wanted to try and produce hip-hop records, of all things.
Right. When you were when you started out making records, they were very there was a lot of political content in the records. Was the politics more important than the music for you then?
No, music always most important. Music always most engrossing, involving, you know, since when I was a little boy. Biggest passion. But the politics was important. Very important. You know, and interesting. At the time, I'd come out of art school where the big thing was to ask questions about what did painting mean and how was it significant, modernism, blah, 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 culture. How come, you know, you were being given a grant to spend 4 years in some building throwing paint at a canvas? Or in fact, I was at Leeds shooting budgerigars and walking around with a pole on your head, which is what the glory of conceptual art had brought us at that point. So I was full of questions about pop music, you know, what was this thing that was affecting me so deeply and had all my life? And there weren't many people, it seemed to me, asking very many questions about it amongst those that were involved in making it.
But you're not interested in pop as it's no longer as important that pop is that kind of discourse for you anymore. You're not interrogating pop the way you used
to. I'm not interrogating pop the way I used to, because partly I just ran out of questions for it. Partly it told me to shut up and go away, and partly there are other questions begged elsewhere. There were no final answers to any of that stuff, needless to say. If I held a conviction in the palm of my hand, a day at the start of June, you could see it breathing and I could feed it blood from a spoon. The Republic in a house on the border, in a room where they both were born.
You're back on the legendary indie label Rough Trade after a gap of 20-something years.
Yeah.
You were saying that Jeff Travis has been one of the most important people to you.
Yeah, in my life, definitely. Without him and John Peel, we wouldn't have started. And without him, I don't know where I'd be at the moment. But, and it feels... I think that's the other reason why it's possible to do this and not hate it as much, is that Rough Trade's just a place with real people that really care about music, and it's...
When you had your big major label pitch in the 80s, was that an unhappy time then? Did that success equate proportionally with unhappiness?
It did, in a funny way. I mean, I think that I learnt then that success can make you as unhappy as failure. Didn't agree with me. Felt that was wrong thing for me. Wrong job, wrong man, wrong place, wrong time.
You used to have extreme stage fright and panic attacks about live performance, but you're back performing this year.
Yeah.
You've done your first gigs in 26 years.
Yeah.
What? How did you solve that?
Jeff Travis again had said, well, why don't you play live? You could do it under an assumed name, you could do it at a small venue, and what's the worst that could go wrong? If you don't like it, you don't have to do it again. And I thought, why didn't I think of that? You know, I mean, it seems so obvious, really. And at that point, I'd met a bunch of friends in a pub in Hackney who could all play music a little bit. And I thought, well, if I could do it with these guys, then, you know, none of us has got anything to lose. None of us is particularly... We could just enjoy it. If it goes tits up, it does do. If it's good fun, we could do some more. And the pleasure of doing it did outweigh the anxiety.
So there was a certain amount of anxiety.
Still. Yeah, yeah, but... with each subsequent gig, I think the anxiety gets a little less and the pleasure gets a little greater, definitely. And when the day is done, it's little games of us to make one. I'll close and lock the door and you'll be there.
How much of that political passion still survives, and how much does that motivate what you do now?
I'm still very interested in theory, what people call theory, which is just thinking about things. It's no big deal.
But with a capital T.
latterly, in most book covers, you'll see them preferring strictly lowercase.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I found.
But everything in lowercase.
Everything in lowercase, needless to say. So I am still interested in ideas. That's probably a good thing. For my own survival, I would guess.
You studied fine art at Leeds Polytechnic.
Yeah.
If you'd been a few years younger, do you think you would have been a young British artist by now?
No. No, I wouldn't have trod that path. Doesn't lead anywhere, particularly as far as I'm concerned. Little bit of ornament here and there, bit of decoration. I'm not really that interested or doesn't do anything for me. You know, I'm... Duchamp was my man, and everybody's kind of making ornaments and treading water ever since, possibly.
But you still draw, but you don't...
I like drawing, yeah. No. It's a fantastic thing to do, and it's a wonderful thing to share with friends and family. But how much is Damien Hirst doing this skull for?
Millions.
Millions.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Maybe you took the wrong path.
Possibly, yeah. Possibly.
But the road to no regrets.
Yes, no regrets whatsoever. I was waiting for the time it takes for someone to forget. I was standing on the corner of the road to no regret. Road to no regret. Oh, it's a long way to come. I could hear the voice of reason, I could see the light in the air. I was waiting on the corner of the road to no regret.
Favourite tracks on the new record for you? Do you have them?
Nope. Is there a favourite one I like singing? Not really. It's all, you know, someone else's job to listen to it now.
In your current live set, you're doing covers of hip-hop songs.
I do a couple, yeah.
That's an ambitious thing for a
wine. It's so foolhardy, it works, if you know what I mean. Or maybe it doesn't. It depends on who's in the audience that night. But no, I'm not. You know, I'm not frightened of trying to do something. If there's something I think is a very wonderful piece of work, and I think I could enjoy doing something with it, then I will, despite the disapprobation that it might earn from people who should know better.
The disapprobation is a good thing to earn, as long as you earn it from the right person, I think.
Yeah. You and I agree about a lot of things.
Well, it seems that way.
Oh.
I can certainly bluff my way through it. I've been wanting to run a time. I dream of ending these dreams of mine, of hope, for love forevermore. A chance to adore and be adored. The need for someone new. You came out of the sort of intellectual ferment or cultural ferment of the post-punk era. Why do you think that was such a fertile time for music and ideas?
Something to do with post-war British education coming to a peak at a certain time, and back in those days people being able to get university grants if their parents couldn't afford to send them to university, and it would have had something to do with people getting sick of rock and roll. The other thing that it's to do with, I don't know. I mean, there's obviously a mysterious something.
Cheap sampling technology becoming available, maybe?
Not then.
A lot of working class people going to art school.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. Art schools.
Punk wiping the slate clean and leaving a power vacuum in the middle of British pop music.
Well, I kind of presumed it was punk we were talking about, but...
I'm talking about that immediate post-punk era.
The immediate post-punk... Oh, there were a lot of people around with interesting ideas. Most of them ended up at Rough Trade. It was good. Good time. I'm a little nonplussed as to be able to comment on it myself, because I was there, but...
A lot of modern bands seem to name-check that period, but they seem to have reduced it to a kind of a few spiky guitar riffs.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
Franz Ferdinand, for instance, and Future Heads and people like that. I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that's wrong. Do you see any link between what they're doing and what your generation were doing?
Other than sonically, no, not really.
What's next for you after a white beer, black beer, red beer?
I had the best one of those the other day. I had a Japanese phoner that said it was called white coffee, black coffee. Was the
they?
That's the yeah. I don't know. Playing live is the plan, and then lots more playing live. So
you said that you're kind of confidently back in the game now. I mean, this is a sort of a career for you now.
It's closer to being a proper job than it ever has been. Yeah. Because I've got
these promotional duties.
There's lots of things to do, and I've got a proper band, big, you know, six piece band to look after, and it's a big responsibility.
But you feel happier making music now than you did.
Yeah, that's. I know that sounds kind of trite or something, but it's absolutely true. I generally feel happier about everything, and extraordinarily lucky that someone that's, you know, got to my age and has done as much as he has to sabotage his career many times over, arguably, is still able to make music and given the opportunity to. So I'm very, very, principally, I feel I, at the moment, just incredibly lucky.
Well, thank you very much, Green Gartside of Scritti Politti, for sharing this time in this pub in a sweltering hot day in the middle of central London. And see you down the road somewhere.
See you. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to The Times Podcast, produced by Unique.